Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative medicine practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of Natural Medicine Podcast. Today we're joined by Rochelle Waite, who is a total academic nerd. She's a naturopath. She has postgrads in, God, I hope I get this right. You have no idea how many outtakes we've done. Immunology, reproductive medicine, and women's health medicine. Did I get that right, Rochelle? Hi.
You absolutely did.
How many takes did it take?
I'm not saying.
But everyone, today we're going to be discussing effective perimenopausal management. And what I love about Rochelle is that she has education from both sides of the tracks. So she's not restricted to one paradigm of treatment, if you like, of medicine. So welcome, Rochelle, to Natural Medicine Podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. It is our pleasure. Can you please take us through your career about, I mean, I have to know, were you this much of a nerd when you were a kid?
Yeah, I think I can recall it kicking in at the age of about four, actually. Yeah. I think I read from an early age, from about four. But, anything, everything.
And then what caught your heart with naturopathy? Because you did naturopathy first, correct?
No, I did naturopathy almost last.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Well, in the middle. I started off, as you do science, good at that, go to uni, started off studying nuclear medicine. And by the end of that, discovered that I was probably more interested in research rather than, you know, working in a hospital environment at that stage. So I went into immunology and was in the clinical immunology laboratory at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, Monash Medical School.
Yeah.
And really, I spent probably about 7 years there, you know, getting into all things autoimmunity, really, amongst some teaching and things like that as I went along. And that, two things happened there. Once I, at one point, I had an amazing professor who basically instilled in us that we needed to not just believe what we're told and to actually investigate and research what's going on. And on the other hand, he was a clinician, and I saw some very sick, you know, being a major tertiary hospital, very sick people with autoimmunity. And largely they were told, you've got this disease, here's some methotrexate and maybe some steroids to get you on your way and off you go sort of thing. And that's when I asked myself, you know, under the right circumstances, the body has an amazing ability to heal itself. So why is autoimmunity any different from that? So combining that with my research, which was cellular research at that stage, not particularly clinical. I looked at one protein for 7 years. It was good. And then, combining that, it just led me into the field of naturopathy, really, and looking at health a different way.
Right. So you're in, this is a totally biased sample, but this is just something I appear to have noticed, and that is that many people who are drawn to natural medicine, the medical model failed them. They got sick and the medical model didn't have the answers, and so they fell into it, basically, or they searched for their own personal reasons. But you were a searcher. You were searching for something different, for something more. So you're like, for instance, the first person who I totally admire. Unfortunately, he died. He gave everything to his patients. He was Dr. Kevin Tracy, and mm-hmm. he studied medicine and naturopathy at the same time.
Yeah.
Because he knew that neither had every answer, and he never told either camp, so because he knew he'd get teased.
Yes, well, I'm a little bit guilty of doing that too in my later studies in reproductive medicine and women's health medicine. I entered those courses on the basis of my scientific work rather than as a naturopath, and they didn't know I was a naturopath all the way through those degrees.
But I guess I totally take my hat off to those very strong-hearted and willed naturopaths who actually do the enter as naturopaths and do, women's reproductive medicine, not women's reproductive medicine, reproductive medicine as a postgrad at, one of the Sydney universities. So it takes a strong-willed person to sort of stand up and say, no, this stuff has merit and I'm learning more.
Yeah,
that's really interesting. So then you did firstly immunology, obviously, then reproductive medicine, and then women's health medicine?
That's right, with naturopathy in the middle.
In the middle.
Yeah, after immunology.
Okay, so from your science background, did you actually have any issues with grasping or embracing the paradigms of natural medicine?
No, I didn't. Back in the day when I studied naturopathy, we did things like homeopathy. I did a little bit of that, kind of cut out midway through my course. And even that sort of thing, people say, oh, do you really struggle with that energy sort of medicine, in that ilk? And my response to that is science said, hundreds of years ago that the world was flat. We won't go into the fact that some people still think it is, but... I am not arrogant enough to think that I know everything and that science currently has all the answers. So if something works anecdotally or, even through experimentation that doesn't fit the gold standard double-blind placebo criteria that the scientific model demands these days, doesn't mean to say that it doesn't have validity.
Yeah.
So I bring everything to the table, really. Having said that, I guess... I am a naturopath that is more leaned towards the medical model, but I still look at everything from a very fundamental cellular level, which is what I think the medical model lacks.
Gotcha. And I was going to say something earlier about your frustrations with that medical model about, treatments. What is it? Etiology unknown, treatment symptomatic. It just recycles. This is something that Kevin Tracy told me. He got sick and tired of hearing that iteration again and again, and he just got, oh, my God, there's got to be something more. So so let's go into our topic today, perimenopause first. We need to review it. Now, I know that our audience is going to be practitioners mainly, but let's review things because we think that things don't evolve in medicine, and they actually do. So can you take us through a quick review of perimenopause, the main issues facing women, both symptomatically and biochemically?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously perimenopause is the time period where we transition from our reproductive years to our non-reproductive years. And for a lot of people, that can take a long time, up to 10 years, it can take a long time to then go through into menopause. Now, during that time, particularly the medical model looks specifically at decreasing progesterone, I guess, and fluctuating and then decreasing estrogen. Often that's where it finishes. There's no regard for maybe, even if we're just looking at the ovaries, testosterone, for instance, which can have major ramifications for intimate relationships, but also energy and muscle strength and all of those sorts of things. Even more apparent is the effect of these waning or fluctuating hormones on cortisol production and the ability to have some stress resilience, which leads to probably the primary... Well, one of the primary symptoms that I see in perimenopausal women, which is stress and the ability to cope with it, and then, the resultant fatigue that ensues, and then maybe anxiety that comes as a result of that. Remembering that all our endocrine organs essentially can be considered an ultra-high-speed traffic network. They're all interlinked. And if you've got one major organ pumping away extra hard, all of them have to try and cope And in, I guess, the context of perimenopause, when you've got things like maybe insulin resistance making the pancreas work harder, or high stress levels and increased cortisol demands, you know, you've got all that happening and your system's activated to try and keep up, but your poor ovaries are trying to retire, you know, and, you know, it causes imbalances and strains all over the place.
So along that biochemical pathway, we've spoken about cortisol. And of course, you know, the major, I was going to say travesty, but the major hurdle to all health conditions in the 21st century is stress. So I was going to ask this later, but I think it's probably apt to ask now. When we're talking about hormonal upset, and not just sex hormones, but obviously metabolic hormones, do you work right back at these environmental antecedents to the imbalance in the hormones?
Realistically, in this day and age of our, well, you know, from an Australian perspective, if not, you know, other countries, the major impact on hormonal levels I see as being an issue of increased carbohydrate consumption, you know, crap, basically. I'm not vilifying the good carbs. But really, you know, I say to my clients, you know, if you're considering all your organs trying to function normally and trying to keep that traffic flow normal and even, you don't want any one organ going mad. Now, not only is largely pancreatic, you know, insulin release a problem, but even if it's not, and say stress is the major thing, we don't have a whole heap of conscious control over endocrine secretion, basically. I mean, we all know how, you know, useful it is to think, I'm not hungry, I'm not hungry, I'm not hungry. I mean, it's a hormonal response. We can breathe, and that has an effect on things, and we can do yoga and relax and all of that sort of thing. However, there are also limits to that. But the one organ that we absolutely can control in the mix of all of that is our pancreas. Theoretically, we can control what we put in our mouth. So I find that manipulating that is enough to, let's say, calm the farm with respect to getting that traffic flow a little bit even and just a little bit less angsty. And in that regard, then stress response becomes a little bit easier, and then you can start snowballing forward rather than snowballing backwards.
This is a really interesting point to intercede at, the pancreas, rather than, you know, what we would ordinarily think is the place to intercede is, you know, giving the quote unquote, but the female herbs. And
yes.
So can I ask, with regards to interceding with settling the pancreas down on an exocrine point, so for instance, digestion, do you find that it goes hand in hand, that the endocrine secretions are therefore normalized and, you know, they calm the farm?
Yeah, I guess personally I look at everything more endocrinologically. But, yeah, absolutely. I mean, from a basic premise of health, which we, you know, need to acknowledge before we go in and try and manage a phase like perimenopause or menopause, people's problems are chronic inflammation and poor gut health. You know, one is a result of the other. So, of course, exocrine, pancreatic exocrine things, that, you know, parameters are going to have an effect as well. It's something that both things really need to be looked at because, I mean, you know, obviously good gut health increases appropriate neurotransmitter, you know, hormone production, not to mention, you know, nutrient uptake and vitamin production and all of those sorts of things. It all needs to be looked at together.
Yeah. Okay,
and so that's without prescribing herbs or actually trying to physically manipulate a system. We're actually trying to restore it to normal before we even see what's left over.
So what about the major symptoms impacting women? So how it impacts their energy, their mood, their psyche, their sexuality, how they feel about their body image. What are you seeing? And how do you start off that conversation when they present with saying, I'm sick of this, I want something done?
Absolutely. I think that the whole perspective of people, you know, if they're coming to me within that perimenopausal time frame, they all know that they're perimenopausal. Mm. That's why that they've finally made the decision to kind of do something about it. And it is a multifactorial thing in my mind. And a lot of the things that I do for these clientele, I would actually do for a 20-year-old too if they had similar issues. So they're not necessarily specific to the fact that, you know, their hormone levels are fluctuating due to the fact that they're in perimenopause. We need a lot of, I think it comes down to the fact that a lot of health messaging that we've received over the last 100 years has been deleterious to our health, really, particularly with women. The two things, that fats are bad, and that still predominates our health messaging, but also that in the grasp of some idealistic shape that we need to restrict what we're eating. And restrict anything, really. It's not even just limited to nutrition, really. But this adage that we need to restrict calories, for instance, to lose weight, well, we all know that that doesn't work. And it is that notion that we're actually built from an evolutionary perspective on feast and famine. You know, I do discuss with my clients, you know, thinking about our caveman ancestors. And it's a shock of a lot of people to learn that, you know, we really haven't changed much over that time period. Yes, our brains developed, but I mean, if we look at an ape, our basic physiology hasn't altered all that much at all. You know, if the caveman goes into, you know, comes out, feast, summertime, feeds on his woolly mammoth, high calories, high insulin, stores the fat as, you know, for the winter, insulin being our fat storage hormone rather than worrying about its glycemic control. Most of us are in that cave, that self-protective, our metabolism shifts downwards to maintain life. Yes, we can keep our heart beating, but it's that protective mode that everyone seems to be in because of, I mean, the body doesn't discriminate on the type of stress. It could be nutritional famine, but it can be just as much an idiot boss, busy roads, or children. So we need to basically, I tell my women that we need to come out of the cave. We need to think abundantly, provide our body with everything that it needs to flourish, not just survive. Now, that includes nutrition, but that could include sex. That could include, you know, laughter, all of that sort of thing. And that actually has a huge impact on, once again, calming the farm with respect to stress response, which then in turn calms the thyroid, which then feeds back onto the pancreas. You know, it all interplays together.
Yeah, but there's an interesting point there, and that is the term stressor. So if we think about hunger being a stressor, or indeed is food, too much food the stressor. But, you know, we talk about the benefits of intermittent fasting, and yet the more that you fast for, the number of hours that you fast for, you actually get changes in HbA1c, sorry, not in HbA1c, it's long term, in fasting blood glucose level, in cholesterol levels, in stress response markers. So how does that tie in with is fasting a stressor, or is it indeed initiating, dare I say, a vagal nerve response?
Well, I think we need to look at fasting in terms of, I mean, it's a complex thing. But, you know, when we're talking about getting into that protective mode, we're talking about fasting for long periods. And when we're talking about that sort of fasting within the context of everyday life, we're really talking about just eating crap and not actually getting the nutrients that you want, rather than not having any caloric input. I mean, we know that, you know, the benefits of decreasing insulin and, you know, increasing growth hormone and all of those sorts of lovely things that happen during intermittent fasting are beneficial, but we're not talking there for periods of a month, you know, where you have no intake. Once again, I mean, we're getting a little off topic, but kind of not. Our hunger, really, you know, when we take away the sugar cravings and that sort of roller coaster addictive sort of side of things, our hunger is dictated by the need and the search for protein. So, you know, and evidenced by the fact we can eat crap all day long, but unless you've got protein, you're still going to feel hungry. And we see that a lot. And in fact, most, because a lot of women that come and see me have been on that dieting sort of thing that restrict calories, the problem is that they're not getting enough protein, which then goes to how well the thyroid can function and muscle mass and energy production generally and things like that.
It's so intertwined, because you've got protein intake and then you've got protein utilization, which, as yes. you said, the thyroid requires it, but the thyroid also governs it as well. So there's
that's this right. whole interplay. So we need to get into that positive snowball effect rather than the negative snowball effect. And look, everything to do with hormones has the same sort of problem.
Yeah, but I'm picking up your concentration on looking at the pancreas, looking at digestion as a point to intersee that rather than all of this downstream stuff.
It is the point. It is something that we can control.
Mm.
And really, there's very little else that we can control with respect to metabolic function, as opposed, okay. you know, apart from putting what we can put in our mouth. And, yeah. you know, obviously things like making sure that you have good, nutritious, you know, foods to feed your gut bacteria and, you know, veggies and things like that are important too. But I find from a practical purpose and actually getting results from my clients, if they don't have that glycemic control, that's the first thing that's, you know, gotta happen.
Just blocking everything else. Yeah. All right. So when we're talking about the major symptoms that your patients present with, mm-hmm. can we just go through the major symptoms that patients seek help for with perimenopause, please?
Largely, in no particular order, but largely it's fatigue. Insomnia and anxiety are the big three that I see. Now, obviously, people that have probably more complex hormonal dysregulation come with, you know, things like vaginal dryness and you know, more specific areas that need working on. But the big ones are fatigue and not being able to get through the day, largely. I'm just trying to think what else. Libido, for instance, you know, really only comes in a subset of people. But the big general ones are the anxiety, which is very common, fatigue and insomnia.
Gotcha. And things like mood, foggy brain fog.
Of course,
yeah. Yeah, cortisol. You know, you can relate all of these back to those stress hormones, can't you, a lot of the time. What treatment options are offered women for severity? So, for instance, with women with hot flushes, you know, is it like, look, we can work on this part, but for that part you really need to see your doc about some possible HRT, because it's, you know, you've got a huge score on the, you know, Kuppelmann index or whatever like that. Can you take us through how you assess them, how you recommend what sort of treatment route they should go down?
Realistically, I guess I'm a little bit different to what you might think I'd be. I very rarely need to go down the medical model for uncomplicated perimenopause, menopause sort of thing. You know, if you've got major medical issues and a ton of medications, then it might be different.
Yeah.
But where I differ in one point is I very, very, very rarely measure blood levels of hormones. Right. Which is your standard practice in the medical model, and their standard practice is to measure hormones if they're low. It's 50-50, really. Hormone replacement therapy, which is not called anymore, menopause replacement therapy, is often offered, but even doctors are hesitant to go there because of whether it be bioidentical or not. They're often hesitant to go there because of the risks of, you know, estrogen and cancers and clotting and all of that sort of thing. More often than not, they send people down the path of SSRIs, antidepressant medication. I find, going back to hormonal blood measurements, that because of the fluctuations, not only cyclically, if you're still having some sort of cycle, but also the fluctuations due to the perimenopause, and also fluctuations of hormones on a daily basis, that in fact the results with it don't really give much information.
Right.
You know, if you've completely bottomed out and you have no testosterone or something like that, yes, but a thorough history taking tells me all of that anyway. Based on the symptoms that they're telling me, I can generally give a pretty good guess. Now, there are things that I address within the whole realm of this sort of thing, whereas that wouldn't be looked at within the medical model. One thing, well, obviously I've talked about gut health, so I look at that, but one thing that has a real bearing on basic cellular health is fatty acid metabolism, which gets lost in the whole messaging. Now, apart from anything else, Physiology 101 states that the primary ingredient for steroidal hormone production is LDL, low-density lipoproteins, or our bad cholesterol. Mm. Now, everyone is hell-bent on decreasing their LDLs to a level unheard of.
Yes.
Also by the use of statins, which puts a roadblock in our metabolism anyway, that the majority of people don't have primary ingredients for their steroid hormone production. And, you know, and that's just not progesterone and estrogen and all those things. We're talking cortisol, we're talking aldosterone, you know, that puts stresses back on the adrenal glands to produce more. So that's where we can get into an awful lot of trouble. Now, that goes back to the whole fat is bad scenario too. I'm not scared of saturated fats, but what we need to look at is the metabolism of and the incorporation of essential fatty acids into the cell membrane. Because we have, say, our omega-3s, which are our beautiful antioxidant fatty acids. We have our omega-9s, which are our beautiful, omega-3s, our beautiful anti-inflammatory fatty acids. Omega-9s, our antioxidants. We have our omega-6s, which are our pro-inflammatory fatty acids. Now, they're still essential. We need them as a, let's go back to basic ingredients, a basic ingredient of arachidonic acid in the inflammatory pathway. We need it for an immune response. But the thing is, we're getting far too many in our everyday diets because of the inclusion of seed oils, the canolas, the rice bran oils, all the, you know, oils that are cheap and nasty and prolific in any processed foods. So I actually look at the ratio between the omega-6s, which are very pro-inflammatory, and the omega-3s in the blood, because current research states that we need a ratio of about 3 to 1. Now, the average Australian ratio is at about 15 to 1 with, you know, too many omega-6s, which means everyone is inflamed. Yep. Now, these fatty acids incorporate into the, you know, the fatty bilayer of every cell. So if you've got a ton of omega-6s that are incorporated in with their longer chain length, the cells are essentially hardened and inflamed, which means that cellular signaling cannot occur efficiently, which means you may not get energy production within the cell, protein production, you know, gene regulation, all nutrients in, nutrients out, all the beautiful things that happen within individual cells. So that goes back for me to, and this is for generalized health, but if every individual cell is inflamed and not working efficiently, how can we expect whole organs to do it?
Mm.
Whether it be the pancreas or the liver or the ovaries. So I really look at that because it really can reverse health issues and hormonal control very quickly.
You know what, Rochelle? I'm finally waking up to something that I thought I knew. Like, it is known. It's, you know, from the extremely good work done by Felice Jacka and others, but with her work with good food, allaying or mitigating or abrogating depression. You've got the work done, forgive me, I can't remember her name. She's a Brazilian researcher, I think, South American, and she looked at trans fats and depression. So I get that I'm segueing here. Yep. But when you think about, it is known that a poor diet will affect gross, if you like, conditions. Why don't we start with nutrition, with, you know, the sex hormones, which when you think about it, we need that nutrition for building blocks. So it's like a duh.
Yeah.
And yet myself, and I'm going to bet many naturopaths out there, because of what we're taught, how we're taught, is like these are the female hormones, these are the female herbs for the female conditions, rather than, hang on a tick, let's go way back up, right back up to digestion, get the building blocks through, and then you'll find, as you said, Once the cells work, the organs work. Once the organs work, they produce the right stuff. So I can just see it's like a duh, an aha moment that's been hit across the head with a piece of 4x2 wood. Yep. How stupid of me.
So it's interesting, you know, because I've been trained in all this, you know, reproductive medicine and women's health medicine and all the, you know, what goes on and physiologically, it never goes back to cellular health, and I see the results. So yeah. I very rarely have to refer someone on for hormone replacement therapy of any description. I very rarely, although I love herbs, very rarely prescribe herbs for those, you know, women's herbs, as you said. Yeah. You know, I might prescribe Gymnema for blood sugar regulation if they're having problems with that sort of thing. You know, I still do use herbs within my practice.
Yeah.
But I really go back to getting that omega-6 to 3 leveling right, and there's blood tests that determine that. I have a very beautiful blood test that I use that breaks it down into the fatty acid metabolism is completely broken down, the levels of different fatty acids, so that I can tell whether, you know, the brain, for brain fog, for instance, uses a different ratio of fatty acids than, say, kidney control does and aldosterone production and things like that. So it's all broken down. And so I can actually target areas that are right. And I don't have to do much after that. Once you write that basic cellular health and then promote very good gut health, which comes back to nutrition as well, and get that appropriate vagus nerve response, has a huge bearing on then feeding back into every other of the endocrine organs, which means the ovaries can then do what they need to do with respect to retirement.
Can I just go back to a point you made before? You said about that LDL specifically, rather than cholesterol, is the building block of the sex hormones. That's really interesting to me. Have we got research to show that?
That's what I was taught, and that's what was in my textbooks. But cholesterol as a whole. But even so, when I, for instance, make sure that my perimenopausal women have an appropriate amount of omega-3s, it writes their hormonal control anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe any fat, you know, there are other fatty acids that do contribute to that, but, you know, it's the LDL subretch that's most effective or something.
Yeah. And for our audience who's listening, just to make sure that we have a little bit of a glossary here, when I say the word cholesterol, I mean the molecule cholesterol, not lipoproteins, which we always say the word cholesterol for, which is a misnomer, but we all fall into it. I do it every day, and I kick myself for doing it.
Well, that comes down to something else that I do with my women as well, is don't sweat the small stuff, Andrew. That's not that bad.
Oops. I tend to do that. Investigations. You've mentioned quite a lot, but what about, as I mentioned before, things like looking at you know, HbA1c, for instance. You've mentioned the omega-3 to omega-6 ratio. Yep. What about gut health? What about the microbiota? Do you measure that? Do you look at that? Vaginal microbiome.
Yes, I do. HbA1c is something that, look, I think insulin resistance, which, you know, has a huge bearing on all of this stuff, we tend as clinicians, and this comes from the medical model of seeing people as being either insulin resistant or not.
Yeah.
It's a spectrum, and everyone as they age tends towards insulin resistance. So often I wouldn't necessarily need to test for it because I just assume that everyone is. I want them to, lower that high glycemic sort of environment they may or may not have. However, some clients need to see that test result to be convinced that it's an issue.
Yeah.
So that's where it becomes more important in my mind. Now, with respect to testing the gastrointestinal microbiome, obviously that's huge. We need it, particularly because I have, you know, that subspecialty in autoimmunity, it becomes a very big thing, gastrointestinal permeability and all of that sort of thing. It's a huge part, and we need to make sure the cells are working properly and you know, maintaining that integrity. Also, the big thing for perimenopausal women is sleep. bit of trivia fact for people. When we sleep 6 to 8 hours, and I don't care what people say that they can live on four, that's garbage. During that 6 to 8 hour period in darkness, you know, associated with our circadian rhythms, our gut bacteria consume up to 1 kilogram of yeast every night. And I know this is the case because I do have serially weighing women that come in and say, how can I go to bed one weight and wake up heavier the next morning? It's not just anecdotal. It's in the journals that this is what happens overnight. There's a large yeast consumption. Yeah. In the context of, say, poor gut health, not making enough melatonin because the gut bacteria make 80% of melatonin, you know, if people aren't sleeping well, you get an increase in yeast, which increases gastrointestinal permeability and then causes all, you know, manner of thrush and stuff, which is not aided by fluctuating estrogen. I more often test the vaginal microbiome, especially in women that have, you know, other issues with respect
dryness,
to that.
Recurrent thrush, that sort of thing,
That sort of thing. Rather than the gastrointestinal microbiome, I find that they're pretty well interrelated anyway. But realistically, it's hundreds of dollars cheaper to test the vaginal microbiome than it is the gut. And women seem to be all over it. And they don't worry about self-testing vaginally as opposed to a poo sample.
How really interesting.
Yeah.
When we consider the lack of knowledge of many young women, certainly, about their vagina and what it looks like and what's normal and things like that, it's actually heartening to see these more mature women going, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because post kids start to like,
if you've had kids, it's all, right. All bets are off once you've had kids.
Okay, so let's move on to treatment options. Now, obviously, you concentrate a lot on digestion, but when we're talking about stressors, do you also work in some stress nutrition, stress herbs
absolutely.
To help?
Well, probably not, actually, so much supplementally. I'm not a big supplementer of things. I run a 12-week program, which 3 months is a really nice time for people to get invested in their health. Which is predominantly education. If I could say to practitioners, the one thing you need to do is not tell people what to do. You need to show them why. They need to be education, education, education. And so, for instance, my program has, you know, they get a seminar each week. One might be carbohydrates, one might be proteins, metabolic flexibility, intermittent fasting, ketogenic eating, breathing, functional breathing, sleep, all of those sorts of things that, you know, aren't specific to perimenopause, but are very, very useful. That's where it lies in my experience.
Yeah.
I always, largely always supplement with a very good omega-3 supplement that's very rich in polyphenols. So prackies know, you need the polyphenols, which are missing in a lot of the fish oil preparations, because not only do the polyphenols, which, you know, are present in fish, not only do they prevent the degradation of the fish oil when it's ingested, secondary to that, you need the polyphenols not only to stop them degrading, but you need the polyphenols to actually chaperone those omega-3s into the cells. So when you have that beautiful mix of olive oil and you know, highly concentrated olive oil and omega-3s, it actually gets them into the cells. And when that happens, it preferentially boots out the arachidonic acid,
right,
the inflammatory portion, and then also stops the free metabolism of the arachidonic acid when it's free-floating. So it's really quite amazing.
Right. So several questions here. So one, with the polyphenols, I was very heartened to learn that Australian olive oil, Australian extra virgin olive oil specifically, that there's now a real movement here with a co-op, Australian Olive Oil Growers Association, and it's all to do with quality manufacturing and being transparent to the consumer. So, for instance, I can say this because it's actually already gone through the courts. Bertolli was fined, I think it was $11 million in the United States for adulterating their olive oil with seed oils. I favour Australian olive oils, or indeed I favour any olive oil which states on the level the amount of biophenols. And these are polyphenolic molecules that are actually made upon the manufacturing of the oil. They're not in the olives.
Yep.
So it's the making of the oil that makes it.
The Italians got it right again.
So could you consider if somebody was adverse to fish oil or if they wanted to include this in their diet, that they include, let's say, a fish oil supplement and olive oil with a stated amount of the biophenols to help protect it?
Well, it can't hurt. It can only help. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I use one that's all mixed together, so it's a no-brainer. And in fact, I use it as a salad dressing sometimes too, which is, you know.
And it works well? It doesn't have that real fishy taste?
Doesn't have fishy taste at all.
Ooh, okay.
The very pure, I think the fishy taste that we get, and I mean, even if you look, if you're thinking of even sashimi, doesn't have a really big fishy taste unless it's old, unless those fish oils have started to degrade. And it's the same with these supplements, and I guess that they don't really have a fishy taste if you've got that polyphenol base, because it just stops the oxidation.
Yeah. So a note for our practitioners, this should be, you know, fish oil 101, but maybe it's not with some. And that is that try and with all companies, any company that you deal with, ask them for their Council for Responsible Nutrition voluntary monograph on omega-3s, and that is that you adhere to certain pesticide residues, toxicant residues, and freshness indicators. So, for instance, an oxidative, it's called Totox, and so it's these oxidative byproducts, and they have to be kept to a minimum, and they should be stated. Maybe not on the bottle, but certainly they should have that spec sheet.
Yeah,
from their supplier where they buy their fish from. I mean, most of them are from Peru, but but ask your companies if they can provide that to you. They should be more than willing to provide that to you. Maybe not the company that they purchase it off, but they should definitely have that voluntary.
It's very interesting because you can test for these things.
Yeah.
I have a spot blood test that I actually do in clinic, and that determines, it gives me a whole heap of parameters, as I said, breaks down all the fatty acids. But that will tell you if your fish oil is working.
Uh-huh.
And for instance, I've got a lot of stats because there've been over a million tests done worldwide. We've got to have a chat about the geographical differences in fatty acid metabolism one day too, because that's really interesting.
Sure.
But the Australian average ratio is about 15 to 1. That's what we're at. We need to be 3 to 1.
Yeah.
The average for people taking a fish oil supplement is 11 to 1, which is still not very close to. And look, to use me as an example, I'm pescatarian and I have been for 30 years. I eat salmon twice a day at least, or whatever. I'll probably die of mercury poisoning, but you know, whatever. but I do that, and I also used to supplement with just a standard fish oil capsule, but you know, practitioner only, a stability assured one, and my omega-3 ratio came in at 6 to 1, so still better than 15 to 1, but still not 3 to 1, which tells me two things. The fish oil I was taking was largely ineffective, and secondly, that our fish are not providing enough omega-3s. Forget the plant sources that need to still convert, which is very low. And that is largely because of our farming practices.
Yes.
Everything's farmed. And people think farmed fish happen in Uluru. They happen in the ocean.
No.
And we feed these fish corn and soy, which means the fish don't have appropriate omega-6 to 3 ratios.
Yeah.
But the problem is our wild caught fish are being caught up in this too, because there's spillage of tons and tons of corn and soy into the oceans. So unless I put up my fees and can afford that wild-caught Norwegian organic snap-frozen fish to be shipped over, it's really hard, even when you eat beautifully, to get enough omega-3s, and they're so important in cellular health.
I think it's probably cheaper to have a yearly trip to Seattle and go and get your king salmon burger from the market.
Okay, then.
I mean, it is so red, this flesh. Now, notwithstanding, as you said,
that, I've completely got off topic again.
Yeah, I know. No, but forgive me about, of course, then when we're talking about wild caught there was an issue with, you know, Alaskan salmon, I think it was, with toxicants from mining. But, yep. you know, blah, you know, the problem
it's
is
hard.
Us.
It's
Well, the
it's
problem
hard.
Is us. But yeah. anyway, other treatment options. So things like if you're looking at nutrition and you hearken back to digestion with what you spoke about, if these fish oil supplements aren't working, do you then go back and look at, you know, are we not absorbing things because we're not producing enough pancreatic lipase? Should we therefore look at the cephalic phase of digestion and perhaps using a pancreatic digestive enzyme to help things along? Is that where you sort of intersect?
No, I'm actually the opposite. I go back to the cells. And realistically, if you get enough omega-3s in the presence of polyphenols, the cellular health becomes good. Therefore, the cells produce the energy, then everything rights itself. So no, I very rarely have a person that can't deal with it. I mean, okay. Obviously, I have within my toolkit, I have water-soluble sort of omega-3s for people that don't have gallbladders or have exocrine pancreatic disorders or things like that. I have vegan versions. I have, you know, there's lots that can be done.
Yeah.
But it really comes back to that. But with respect to treatment, yes, I want to get that right. And I want to get gut health supported with a good prebiotic because, once again, I could spend another hour on this, but University of Sydney did a study, basically says you need 30 different fruit and vegetable species a week to maintain gut health. And 95% of Australians get 12.
Yeah.
So I do like to support with a blended prebiotic, which is a blend of lots of different fibres, rather than just one slippery elm or one psyllium or whatever, which expands one population. But we really need to think of gut health in terms of a community. You know, we've got our babies, we've got our teenagers, our workers, our grandparents. If we support the whole community, there's not going to be any crime. The thugs aren't going to get in. Gotcha. So expanding one population by taking maybe slippery elm, which is a beautiful, you know, herb bark, has lots of good properties, but doing that in its entirety will expand big populations of one, but then, you know, maybe your infants are left crossing the roads unattended. You know, it's actually a really good analogy to get people to explain. So I do often recommend a prebiotic formula so that the stress of having to find lots of different foods is taken away from the client, not to replace veggies, for instance, but just to over and above, I guess, so that I don't want people stressing over what they want, they have to eat. You know, I generally say, you know, for the first 2 weeks, they need to concentrate on their protein and they're having fats. If they fill up on that, they're not likely to want to go and grab a packet of chips. So that drives, you know, that stabilizes the insulin response. We've got to talk about water. Everyone's chronically dehydrated. Mm. We need at least 35 mils per kilo. We need to talk about sleep. So these are lifestyle things that can make a huge difference in hormonal control with respect to perimenopause.
It's really interesting how when we're in this bubble, we think about our toolkit rather than other toolkits.
Yeah.
So, for instance, with regards to sleep, it's really highlighted the importance of this with my own experience with a crap mattress and getting a new mattress 2 years ago. Oh, my God, what a difference to restful, refreshing sleep that has made.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Yeah.
Absolutely. And things like, I mean, obviously, if you're addressing all of these things, inflammation decreases and things get better. But, I mean, if you're snoring, if you have sleep apnea, for a period of time, unlike my medical friends, I guess, it's not a permanent state. It doesn't have to be a permanent state. But in the interim, it may well be worth having some CPAP to actually get your oxygen levels up.
Absolutely.
And make a huge, and then start snowballing forward. Doesn't have to be a permanent thing. You know, if you have a non-compliant partner that has no clue, kicking them out of the room if they're snoring, if they're not willing to address their own inflammation, you know, we really need to, you know, start looking after ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really good point that you make there, start looking after ourselves. Like, it's almost like, I'd like to say the year, but it's going to be more than a year, the year of me. Like
2023 is the year of me. Last year was catch up year. People were going mad, rescheduling after school activities for kids, or, you know, climbing that corporate ladder again, or, you know, mopping up the stress of the previous years. There's been a mindset shift and people are starting to look after themselves. But I'd be interested to hear from other practitioners whether that's their experience too. It's certainly mine.
Yeah, but more than that, women, they need to embrace the era of me. And I'm going to harp on this particularly because women give so much. You talk about community, women give so much to the community, not just their own, but everybody else. They are the givers, the carers, the nurturers. And I think it's a real key issue with menopause, perimenopause, that women need to recapture their vibrance, their vitality.
I've got to say, I can tell. You can tell the women that have made the menopausal transition well. They're the sprightly old women that are grabbing life, that are going on cruise ships, that are going out. And it's not about working at the gym, but they're having fun and they're having coffee with their friends, as opposed to the women, no judgment, of course, but the women who kind of see menopausal symptoms and hot flushes, and we didn't mention hot flushes at all, as being normal because their mother suffered through it and their grandmother suffered through it. We've got to change that perspective. And if I can put it out there to practitioners in particular, but anyone that's going through, you know, that perimenopausal stage, that at the time of menopause, essentially your whole body resets. Your immune system resets, your metabolism resets, but there is a mind shift reset too for a lot of people. I see it. Women think, I actually don't care as much about what people think about me, and I can say and do what I want. Now, that's a perfect, absolutely perfect place to be. We want to embrace menopause and perimenopause as a time of rebirth.
Rite of passage, yeah.
But a fabulous rite of passage, not something that's whispered about. And it is harder for some women than others. I don't want to minimize how hard it is, but there's so much that can be done. Yeah.
Do you find that the women that have a harder time during the perimenopause are those women that have suffered proportionally a larger amount of stressors in their life, whether that be physical, emotional, whatever, and that consequently during their reproductive years they have suffered worse periods?
No, I do. People that have high stresses in their life, and once again, they don't have to be emotional, they can be, as we said, any of the stresses, come at a base level that's further away from health. So we need to get them into health before we can get them into calming the farm with respect to hormonal control.
So along that lines, when you're talking about just things that have bang for buck, merit, and that they've got decent punch, you know, things like, for instance, magnesium with regards to not just stress, but also metabolic control.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you tend to use these commonly? Can I get your top five?
Yeah, I do. I use generally a blend of minerals. I don't like necessarily throwing, say, large amounts of magnesium out because it'll disrupt calcium. I don't like throwing a large amount of zinc out because it'll, you know, disrupt copper. So I like the blends of things. And there are some really beautiful blended mineral supplements that offer. And first of all, we have to look at the bioavailability and the forms that you're using. And I think really that's where naturopaths are all over that. Compared to our medical friends, you know, the biglycinates and the citrates and things are very much better metabolized than, you know, say giving people, look at iron, for instance. I mean, people are still getting iron sulfate from chemist shops. I mean, you know, so I like the blends, and there's beautiful blends that have calcium, that have magnesium, that are really, I mean, calcium is really important too with respect to perimenopause and menopause and loss of bone and, you know, osteoporosis and things like that. Chromium is another one that's really good because we want to stabilize blood sugar. There are some really nice mineral blends out there, which I utilize a lot. Some people do need a bit extra magnesium as well. Anything to increase sleep. Glycine's another one. Taurine is another one that I use with respect to perimenopause. You know, Lara Bryden, She's got it. It's all over. Read her book.
Lara Brydon's got everything.
Okay.
I put out a tweet. I said, when Lara Brydon speaks, I listen. Simples.
Basically,
that's it.
That's what I do with respect to mineral supplementation and things like that.
I can't believe how asleep I've been on certain things where I'd go, if somebody presents, there's that flick and you go female herbs. And forgive that it's almost a cliche.
They have their place, but I still maintain that if we even go back to that cellular health thing, if your cells aren't working, your organs can't work. If your organs aren't working, how can you expect a herb to work that's actually meant to work on the organs? Herbs are beautiful and they have a lot of, a substantial place when things go awry. Often, and I'd say 90% of the women that I see perimenopausally that are having symptoms, there's nothing that's actually wrong. They just need to tweak to get their baseline health better, which then their body can ease them into perimenopause without a problem. We overcomplicate things.
Before we start to close off, I really need to ask one other quick question, which is a big lifestyle issue in Australia, and that is alcohol.
Ah, yes. A huge impact for perimenopausal women is the effect of alcohol on sleep. Once again, if you don't get proper sleep, you don't get proper hormonal regulation. It's easy for us to say with respect to a lot of things, cut stuff out. But in the context of afternoon lunch with friends and laughter, a glass of wine isn't that harmful, particularly if you're eating well around it and, your liver's okay. There's a lot of complicating factors with alcohol. But the reality is, particularly in the region that I live in, is that people drink every day and they open a bottle of wine every night while they're preparing dinner and they drink it while they're preparing dinner, then they finish it off when they're eating dinner. It's not conducive to health. So it's a very personal discussion that I have to have with each individual client as to where they sit on that.
One of my big things about alcohol, and I take it back to a cultural perspective, is if you think about the benefits of the Mediterranean diet, we think about eating. And what I think about with the Mediterranean diet is sociability.
Yeah.
So it's the wine in the context of a social vagal nerve stimulated environment. You can eat and drink alone. You can eat a Mediterranean diet in a stressful situation alone if you like, but I'll bet you any money it won't have the beneficial effect.
Got to agree with that. I have the same discussion about bread and toast. Toast, if you've got poached eggs, smoked salmon, feta and avocado and a pan-fried asparagus on the side, is not the same piece of toast as toast and jam.
Yeah,
so, we've got to keep things simple for our clients, but very understandable.
Yeah.
And so they know what they're doing.
And if you've got a methylation issue, organic bread.
Oh, absolutely.
Make sure it's organic.
And if you've got autoimmune disease, you may need to avoid gluten. And there are specific people's cases for specific people. But in general, if we can make things easy for our clients, they're going to be more compliant and they're going to see the benefits, which means they're likely to do more.
What's your biggest call out for practitioners listening today and where can we find out more? Because you mentioned earlier, you've got a 12-week program for your patients. What about for other practices?
Well, that's something to think about. I'm very happy to hear from any practitioner that wants extra advice or support. That's not a problem. I guess my website's the best place to go and I guess you have that in the show notes.
We will.
It's just RochelleWaitNaturopath.com. Call out to prackies, two things. Make everything really sensible and well-informed and not complicated. But with respect to perimenopause and menopause, I am going to be on a soapbox this year. The Lara Brydon soapbox. Menopause is a time of amazing strength and resilience for women. We can make it fabulous. We can all go forward and rule the world if it's all handled correctly. Okay, we need to think of perimenopause as a lead-up time into the beginning of a new life and how fantastic that is with opportunity and things like that rather than, oh, my God, I'm going into menopause. My life is over.
Rochelle, I've loved chatting with you today. Thank you so much for taking us through effective perimenopausal management today on Natural Medicine Podcast. It's been wonderful.
You're most welcome.
And everybody, thank you for listening today. You can catch up on the show notes in this podcast and other podcasts on naturalmedicinepartners.com.au. I'm Andrew Whitfield Cook, Natural Medicine Podcast.